Okay, Proverbs 30, verse 18. What we're going to begin here is a section of examples. He's going to give four examples of this and four examples of that, and we'll just look through that. That really ends the chapter, is the way that he arranges this. A lot of good things we can talk about in there, so let's just begin in verse 18. There are three things which are too wonderful for me, yea, four which I do not understand. The way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent on a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a virgin. These are things which are untraceable, are unknowable to the human eye. You can't tell that this thing has happened just by looking at someone or something in this case. And let's just go through and see that that's the case. An eagle in flight. Can you trace the flight of an eagle 15 minutes after he's passed? You know, you go through the woods and you see a deer's tracks. Can you trace a deer later? You can follow his tracks, right? Do you know an eagle's been there 15 minutes after he's flown by? You can't trace them in the air. That's something that the human eye just, it cannot tell, it cannot know. What about a snake on a rock? Do you know he's been there? Now, a snake on sand, can you trace that? Yeah, you can see where he's been. What about on a hard rock? You don't know he was there. Never know that he made that passing. A ship on the sea, when it first passes by, it leaves a wake. You can tell then. What about 30 minutes later? Do you know that ship's ever been there? It's gone and the wake has subsided, and you never know these things. The last one given there, a man with a virgin, by outward appearance, and let's talk about it in the pure positive sense. We attended a wedding yesterday. Two excellent young people, pure, who had saved themselves for one another. Is that a wonderful thing, to go back to the beginning? Three things which are too wonderful for me? Is that a beautiful, wonderful thing? Absolutely is. Looking at them today, are they physically different, having shared that wonderful thing? I mean, just by looking, could you tell? No, but has something very special happened? Yes. And the reason I believe that all of these are given here, the eagle in flight, the snake on the rock, the ship on the sea, all of these things, human eye can't tell that those passings happen. But who does know? God knows every one of them. He knows the exact flight that eagle took. He knows the path of the snake that's crawled on the rock that I would certainly lose track of. I'd never be able to trace him. He knows the ship in the sea. He knows the man with the virgin. He knows all of these things. I think that's important when you look at the next verse, because now this verse 20 is a negative sense. This is the way of an adulterous woman. She eats and wipes her mouth and says, I have done no wickedness. If a woman commits adultery and then pretends that nothing happened because there's no visible proof, nobody saw it, who knows? God absolutely knows. And these things, and I think all of these things, in 19 we see positive things, in 20 certainly a negative thing, but the idea behind all of them is nothing passes outside of God's sight. He sees everything, good or evil, that we do. If you'll mark your places, turn to Hebrews 4, and we'll quickly put that passage with it. I think it's appropriate. Hebrews chapter 4. If someone will read verse 13 for us.
And there is no creature hidden from his sight, but all things are open and laid bare to the eyes of him whom we have to do.
Okay. New King James, the last part of that says, open to the eyes of him to whom we must give an account. He knows everything. He sees everything. And I can't do anything that will pass outside of his realm of knowledge or his realm of sight. That is both comforting and terrifying all at the same time. And that depends on what situation I'm in with him. If I am walking in the light as he is in the light, isn't it comforting to know that he sees everything? When wrongs are done to his people, does he see it? Will he answer? Sure he will. When I betray him, and when I do things that are abominable in his sight, does he see that? Yeah, and that's a warning, certainly, to everyone, but to us as his people as well. Anything you guys want to bring up on 18, 19, or 20?
He'll handle that as well.
He will. He absolutely will. He knows it. And I think going back to that last point, in Hebrews 4:13, to whom we must give an account. You don't get by. You're not going to get off on a technicality with God. He knows, and He will judge. He will take care of those things. Good. Anything else on that first section? So 21 through 23. For three things the earth is perturbed, yes, for four it cannot bear up. For a servant when he reigns, a fool when he is filled with food, a hateful woman when she is married, and a maidservant who succeeds her mistress. Here are four unbearable things in that these are four types of people who cause conflict because they're obnoxious. And let's just talk about what is meant here. It talks about a servant who reigns. This is a lowly person, and I don't mean humble. This is a person who has low rank, and suddenly they come into higher rank. Suddenly they come into authority. And not a humble person to begin with. They just happen to be at a low rank and they jump many other people. He suddenly comes into a position of power. Someone like that is often eager to show off that power and that newfound authority. They want everybody to know that they are now in charge. What is that like to be around? Have you ever known that to happen? You ever seen somebody go from a low position to a high and they want everybody to know and they will not stop showing? And what's it like to be around? It is irritating. It is just, it's obnoxious and it's just awful. Take with that the next one there, a fool filled with food. Imagine a lazy, ungodly man who suddenly inherits all kinds of wealth. Now, this is a man who has worked for nothing. He's a man who has been good for nothing. And now he's got all kinds of money. What is he like most of the time? What's that personality like? Oh boy.
Hardy person. The pride.
Yeah.
Outwinging everything else.
Yeah, we got to see it a lot in the trust department. People who just made no effort whatsoever. They knew that they had a trust coming due when they hit a certain age. They knew all this money was coming to them, so they didn't even pretend to try. And then it comes sweeping in and they have all of this money and they suddenly have a bevy of new friends who want to be their very best friend. And you warn and you say, look, man, where are these people coming from? None of them had anything to do with you 2 weeks ago. Don't you think that might be a little peculiar? But they don't. And it's just the attitude is one, and Roy mentioned one, of pride and haughtiness, and they won't listen. Becomes obnoxious as well. A hateful woman when married. Bitter and selfish. This is the kind of person who would rub her blessings in the face of others who don't have them. And then a maidservant who supplants her mistress. Success goes to her head. She begins to look down on those who are around her. All of those positions, those things, obnoxious and hard to be around. There's a difference between coming from a low place and being lowly and being humble. And certainly, regardless of where we are, whatever our station in life is, we should be humble. And that includes if any of you become president one day, I hope you'll still be humble. I hope you will. God expects you to. And actually, boy, you talk about a humbling position. That would be a humbling position. You now have the responsibility of leading an entire nation of people. We're certainly talking about appointing elders. That is a humbling responsibility. When the souls of others are depending on you. These things, when success does come to us, when positions of authority come to us, we must remain humble. Because God ultimately is the one who's allowed us those things. Any thoughts on 21 through 23?
I was thinking a little bit about Agar and Hannah. You know, when she allowed her to have conceived by her husband, how she started rubbing it in that she... had this kid and
Hannah
was able to bear the kids and all, so she was rubbing that in and all. So,
Panina, I believe, was that the wife's name? Panina was the other wife that.
She's talking about Hagar.
Oh, Hagar. Oh, I'm sorry. You said Hagar, and I'm thinking Hannah. But yeah, absolutely, Sarah and Hagar. So. Take either one of those examples. You've got someone who rubbed it in the face of the other one. Hagar, Excellent example there. Yeah, that would fall right in with this, certainly, with that fourth point made there. Very, very good. 24 through 28 is one of my favorites. And it's one of those that you can see just by looking in nature. Every one of us has seen ants work. You've seen the stuff they do and what they build. These little bitty things can absolutely take over my whole yard. And I try to stop them all the time. And I use all of these different things, and they're just going to move like 10 feet and build something twice as big, just to spite me, I think. And if I step on an ant, he's done. He cannot stand against me. But they're not going to stop. They are so industrious. And they are so diligent. And there's a lesson to be learned in that. Individually, they're not strong. The ants are not a people strong. But you put them together, what can they do? They will take over your yard if you don't stop them. And there's something to be learned from that. Let's go actually read through the section here. There are four things which are little on the earth, but they are exceedingly wise. The ants are a people not strong, yet they prepare their food in the summer. Have you ever seen them work? See them carry stuff? You see these little bitty ants walking around. They got this big chunk of crumb of something on his head that must be 10 times his size, and he's just carrying along like no problem. That's a lesson for us as Christians. You know, individually, we can do a lot of things, but what if every one of us is carrying the big crumb? What if every one of us is teaching people like he or she should be? What will happen to the church as a whole? It'll grow, right? What will happen to the gospel in this area? It'll be taught. It'll grow as well. We need to see these great, great examples. They prepare ahead for hard times to come. They're actually used as an example. Mark your places. Turn back to Proverbs 6. Ants are used as an example for a lazy man to take heed to. It's been a while since we studied in Proverbs 6. But do you remember when we talked about this? Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise, which having no captain, overseer, or ruler, provides her supplies in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. They work and they set back. And they prepare for difficult times ahead. Certainly they are busy and they are diligent. The next one mentioned there are the rock badgers. And some of your translations may have rock hyraxes. I think some of them say conies in there. How are they described? What are they physically like?
Not mighty.
Yeah, they're feeble. They're weak, not mighty at all. But they're wise. Remember, all four of these have wisdom. So what do these do that makes them wise? They are weak physically. So what do?
Build a house in a rock.
Yeah. They build their houses in the rock. So they surround themselves in these craggy areas that basically become a fortress for them. Predators can't get to them. They can go in and out how they want to. They're safe in there. I think we can make an application. Do I build my house on the rock? Right? Can I make that application? Jesus talks about the importance of having him as our foundation. Do I do what these animals do physically? Do I do that spiritually? They are weak in and of themselves, but they're wise when they surround themselves with the rock, when they build on the rock. That's what we need to do with our Lord as well. Let's look at the next one. The locusts have no king, yet they all advance in ranks. They have nobody to command them, yet they work in perfect unison. What if we did that? What if we did that? Just taking the initiative to do what is right because it's right. And then as a group, what could we accomplish? We talked about this before. The ants make the application of the locusts as well. You just keep moving forward. You keep doing not what is best for you, but what is best for the whole group. What is best for your brethren. What will happen because of that?
Stronger.
We think of locusts, we think of destruction. But I think the point is, do they get a lot of work done? A swarm of locusts? Boy, they go to work. And they can completely change the landscape around them. What about a group of Christians who are busy? Can they go to work and change the face of the landscape around them if they're doing what they're supposed to? We can make that application. We can we may look at this and say, oh, that's Old Testament wisdom. We're talking thousands and thousands and thousands of years. That's ancient. It's still applicable spiritually for us now. And then let's look at the last one there in that section. The spider skillfully grasped. Some translations have lizards there, and I think you can make the application either way. Skillfully grasped with its hands, and it is in king's palaces. Spiders or lizards, either one. They're small, they're weak, but they can cling to walls and ceilings, and they can get into places that you and I will never get. I will never go to the White House. And I don't see that happening. But there are spiders and lizards there right now. Probably in the president's bedroom. They can get anywhere. They use their talents that they have to get into all kinds of places. Do we use the talents we have to get where we need to be? To get where we can do the most good? Okay. Any comments on any of those?
You know, that's, I think you look at this, especially on the human side, of your things being destructive and nuisance and stuff like that. But like you said, and the overall picture to us as Christians, we are strong together when we do those things. You know, when we do things that are spiritual, but like you said, these things here, example showing that for us, they're not a good thing as what they do, but like you said, us coming together, being strong. You know, we see how collectively we get things done.
Yeah. You know, and to go back to the ants, I don't know that I've ever seen an arrogant ant who just decided, you know what, forget you guys. I'm going to go do what I want to do. You take care of your stinking ant bed. I'm tired of this. I'm fed up with you. I can't get along with you. You guys are always arguing and taking my leaves and taking my crumbs. You can have it. I've never seen an ant do that. When you see one, what do you usually see? There's a trail of his buddies right behind him because they work together and they lead each other in where they need to go, and then they go and they work. I've never seen any of them holding picket signs on strike saying, you know, you guys, our pay is not what it needs to be. I'm not carrying this stuff back. They work and they work hard and they follow each other. They work together. As Norris pointed out, there's just so many good lessons we can learn from that.
Very good. Yeah. You know, like we look at God created them. We can't get rid of them.
Yeah.
They're here forever and they're here for a purpose.
Yeah.
Like you said, that's the reason of being here. But like, see, our example is to look at them as how they do their work together.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a vivid example. I think that's why I like that section. I can see that. Some of this stuff, yeah, I have to imagine what is it like to be a king. Well, I have to kind of imagine that. I know what ants look like and act like. That's something that I've seen all my life. So we can make the applications there. That's good. 29 through 31. These are things that are majestic. And we'll just kind of look at them together. I think maybe the strongest point is being made there at the end. And a lot of these things, I think, keep coming back to similar applications for us. But 29, here are three things which are majestic in pace. Yes, four which are stately in their walk. A lion, which is mighty among beasts and does not turn away from any. A greyhound, a male goat also, and a king whose troops are with him. When you think of lions, what do you think of? Powerful. King of beasts, right? That they are. When you think of, go back to medieval times, and so many kings, for their family crests, they had lions on them. Well, why do you think they did that? What were they trying to say about their family, their lineage? We are strong, and we are prideful, and we are mighty, and not to be messed around with. We are the kings. We are the rulers over these people. Greyhound there, a lot of translators think that maybe something along a peacock is the idea of something that shows itself as being as sort of flourishing when it walks and walks in a stately manner like that. A he-goat leads the entire flock, and he walks about with that knowledge. He knows that he is in charge of that. And then I think all of those lead up to the last point there. A king with his army. Why can a king with his army with him walk in a stately manner?
To protect him.
Because I have an army behind me. there's something simple but true about that. A king on his own is not that intimidating, really. Right, what if he is in his his enemy's land and he's all by himself. Are you intimidated by that king? What if he brings his army of 100,000 with him? Well, yeah, yeah. He has that power with him. And can we make any application spiritually from that point?
If you go back to a lot of David's examples, we're small on our own, and we don't have to have armor behind us if we have God behind us.
Yeah.
We can be not proud, but we can be confident.
Yeah.
I think there's a big difference between the two. But no, we can definitely be confident if we are living the kind of life where God is on our side.
There's a big difference between boldness and arrogance.
Yeah.
And boldness is confidence. Like Les said, I should be bold to teach people about the gospel, knowing that it's right and it's what my God wants. And whatever consequences come, let them come, because it's still right and it's still true. I was talking with a friend of mine yesterday. We were joking about how anytime we go somewhere, we get lost, because that's a fact. Don't ever let me lead you anywhere when we go on vacation. We're going to get lost at least once. And we did when we went to the wedding yesterday. But anyway. But he said, you know what? I think of it like this. I'm never lost. The Lord's always with me. I may not be exactly where I plan to be at the time I plan to be there, but the Lord's always with me. We'll be okay. We'll get there eventually, and we'll be in good shape when we get there. And I thought, well, that's a good point. Good point, man. Go ahead, Joe.
I think a great example of this is when the Israelite partition, if you have it, Samuel, or king, not realizing they had the greatest king
yes.
that could ever live, but in their mind, he wasn't the one they could see daily. They wanted someone to lead them that they can see. They wanted that symbol. They wanted that crest, that lion-like image before them.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when God gave it to them, how shortly did it take them to realize you're giving up the greatest king ever?
Yeah. What a great point. And certainly that taking place is in our recent reading in 1 Samuel. We see 1 Samuel 8 and 9 there. And when the people ask for a king, Saul comes to power after that. Joe was right. And Samuel, you remember how upset he was when the people start asking for a king. I mean, he really feels like he's failed. You know, Lord, you are their king. Why are they rejecting it? And Samuel feels like he failed. And I think we can do that. There are times where we feel like we haven't done our job as Christians. But what does God say to Samuel? They're not rejecting you, Samuel. They're rejecting me. And that's when you and I teach the gospel and it is rejected, we take it personally a lot of times. I do. I just feel like, man, what did I do wrong here? They're not rejecting you and they're not rejecting me. They're rejecting him as their king. And certainly that first Samuel example is a very good one for us. Why did they want a king? Do you remember?
Everybody
else has a king. Everybody around them had a king. And then, you know, I'm just trying to think, when you go back through, how did that work out for everybody else? You know, where is Moab today? How about Edom? Have you heard about them lately? You know, and you can just go through and look at all these who had kings. And as Job said, they had the greatest king imaginable, who had their greatest good in mind, which a lot of earthly kings don't, by the way, and yet they rejected him. What? Now, let's make a spiritual application from that. They had God as a king. We have him in an even better way as a king. If we reject him, what fools we are. We have an opportunity to be part of his kingdom, to be his people, actually to be his priests and serving him. And we can make the same foolish mistake that Israel did. Certainly believe that they are. That is given to us as an example for us to see the mistakes they made. Very good. Well, let's look at 32 and 33. This is going to end up the section offered by Agur here in Proverbs 30. And how he ends is interesting to me. He ends with this final appeal for humility from those who would be reading this. Verse 32, if you have been foolish in exalting yourself. So he's been telling all of these things. Here's an example of these things, four things that are small, but they are wise. And he goes through all these things. And then it's like he turns directly to the reader and says, now look, if you have been foolish in exalting yourself, if you've devised evil, if you've chased after it, put your hand on your mouth. What a great piece of advice. Where have you heard that before? Somebody say that about himself.
Job.
When he's basically trying to argue with God, and he finally says, you know what, I'm just going to stop that because that's not working. It's not ending well. For as the churning of milk produces butter, the wringing of the nose produces blood, so the forcing of wrath produces strife. If we have started foolishness, what should we do? If I have read through this chapter of wisdom and I realize I'm out of harmony with it, I realize I'm doing foolishness, what should I do now?
Change.
Put my hand over my mouth, stop doing what I'm doing, and fix it. That's the parting words of wisdom that Agur gives us, and it's some very, very good ones. If you keep doing the same old thing, what happens? Same result. Yeah, I mean, it's going to add. If you keep churning milk, you're going to produce butter. If you keep squeezing the fire out of your nose, it's going to bleed. I mean, these things are going to happen if you keep pressing. You keep acting in a wrathful way, strife will come from it. Those who make trouble get trouble. That is guaranteed to happen. Any thoughts on this chapter as a whole that you'd like to mention? Okay, let's get to 31. Proverbs 31 is primarily dedicated to describing how precious a godly woman is. Now, that's going to begin in verse 10 and go through the end of the chapter, verse 31. There is a section in front of that we'll talk about first. But just as we think about this, one of the greatest tributes that could ever be paid to any woman is for someone to compare her to the woman that's described here. This is an incredible description of a woman who loves the Lord, loves her family, loves her husband. And sometimes, you know, someone might say, well, you know, I'm not married. I don't have children. There are still plenty of points being made here in this section on how to be a godly woman. Many of these things can still be done without that being the case. And I would encourage all of the women here, read this on a regular basis and just ask the question as you go through it. Is that me? Is that me? Am I doing that? Now, for us as men, we need to do some very similar things. I remember Stan Adams telling me when he found out I was going to start preaching, you need to read 1 and 2 Timothy. And you need to go through and ask yourself, is this me? Am I doing this as a preacher? Men, especially those of us who are married, we need to go to Ephesians 5 and read through and ask, am I doing this toward my wife? Is this the kind of man? Am I to the point where I would give my life for her because she's that precious to me? Just like Christ gave His life for the church. So this is not just something that women should do. We have plenty of opportunities, male, female, as older or younger Christians, to do this. But since we're here, I would certainly encourage the ladies to do that. This is a wonderful, wonderful section of Scripture. She is a woman of excellent character. She is a woman of moral strength. And this description is not a one-time thing. This is the description of a lifetime of dedication to the Lord. I think that's one of the things that's really special that stands out here. So we will talk about that. Let's look at the first section first. The first part of this chapter centers around advice on good leadership. And it's interesting because it's given to a man named King Lemuel from his mother. She is teaching him wisdom. She is teaching him what a king needs to know to be a good king. Who is King Lemuel? There are different suggestions. He's never mentioned again in the Bible, and that has led people to think a couple of different things. Some think that symbolically, the name Lemuel, by the way, means unto God. So there are many who think that symbolically he represents all godly rulers. Anyone who would be a ruler that would serve the Lord, Lemuel stands in their place, and this applies to them. I think you can certainly make that point. That's a fair point. Some think that symbolically he stands for Solomon himself. Maybe so. I don't know. Either way, can we learn from this? Sure. I don't have to know who Lemuel is to know that these things, these applications need to be made and they're solid. Let's look at 1 through 3. The words of King Lemuel, the utterance which his mother taught him, "What, my son, and what, son of my womb, and what, son of my vows? Do not give your strength to women, nor your ways to that which destroys kings." I really think the first three verses is stressing how a king needs to keep himself pure. He needs to be pure in his behavior. Beware of ungodly women who would lead you astray. Now, if this is referring symbolically to Solomon, that's an interesting comment, isn't it? And apparently something he didn't listen to very well. What happened to Solomon ultimately? He had all of those wives and all of those concubines. And what did they do for him spiritually? Turn him away from the Lord. And why is that so frustrating to read as a Bible student? When you read of that happening there, you just say, how in the world? How does this happen? Even Nehemiah talks about it. Nehemiah 13, verse 26. "Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things?" Of course, this is right after talking about how the Israelites had intermarried with foreign women, and they've got children who can't even speak the language of Judah. They have children speaking the language of Ashdod. They don't even know their own national language there. And he says, "Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him who was beloved of his God. God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, pagan women caused even him to sin." And this goes back to the point that Roy was just pointing out. With all of that wisdom, what still happened?
Sin.
Still sin. Now there is a lesson behind that for me as well. Can I learn and gain wisdom from this book? Can I gain a lot of wisdom from this book? What do I still have to do?
Put it into action.
I still have to put it into practice. You can know page to page everything that it says and still not do it. That's a warning for us. If Solomon, with all of that wisdom, still fell into sin, I certainly can too. It's a warning for us as we go through it. What is a ruler to use his authority for? To do good. To do good for whom?
For himself and his people.
Yeah. His people, the concern for his people. That's what he's been given that authority to do. It's not so he can just say, "Well, I can live it up now. Look at all these resources I now have as king. I can just do whatever I want." His authority has been given to him by God to do good for the people, to do what is best for them. And this is something I really believe his mother here is cautioning him. You start dealing with ungodly women, you give yourself over to those things, it's going to cost you and it's going to get you in trouble. Do you think his mother would know about that kind of stuff? Do you think she's ever known any ungodly women? Probably so. And so certainly if this is a literal man, this advice coming from his mother is quite powerful. And those 4 through 7, she gives another warning for him. Things that rulers are to stay away from that would damage their ability to be the good rulers that they're supposed to be. "It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink." Why? Because she doesn't just say don't do it. Then she gives the reason. Why? Because these things can lead you to forget the law and pervert justice. What is his purpose? To do good for the people. We talked about that. What's one of the ways he does that? Law and justice, right? And anything that would get in the way of that and make it to where he's not at his best ability able to do that, he's to stay away from. And his mother here gives him that warning. It's not for kings and princes. It's not for those who would lead others to go to these things, because they get in the way. They cause trouble. They cloud the mind. And then she gives this example there in verse 6. Who's strong drink for? Who do you give it to? Give it to the dying. Give it to the suffering. That's the only ones it can benefit. What a powerful statement being made there. She is warning him, stay away from these things that would cause you to not be able to be the ruler you need to be. Any thoughts on 4 through 7? I'm going to bring up.
Those are good warnings for everybody, not just kings.
Yeah.
You know, we can all learn from those.
This is, stay pure. Stay away from anything that would cloud your judgment. Does that apply to every Christian? Mm-hmm. Stay pure. Stay away from anything that would compromise your ability to make wise, godly decisions. We can all make application. This section closes with 8 and 9. And this is, so she's told him, first of all, don't do this. Don't do this. In 8 and 9, what does she tell him? Do this. This is what you are to do as a king. Open your mouth for the speechless. In the cause of all who are appointed to die, open your mouth, judge righteously, and plead the cause of the poor and the needy. Kings are not to give themselves over to uncleanness, things like fornication. Kings are not to give themselves over to the allure of wine. You can go back to Proverbs 21 for that, or Proverbs 20, verse 1. Kings are to give themselves over for the defending of the weak. They are to take care of those who don't have the power to take care of themselves. This is what a good ruler is to do. And in that sense, what does the ruler become when he does that? What does he become an extension of? Let me ask it that way. He becomes an extension of God's own justice. And that is exactly what God has always intended for kings to be. Especially those who would call themselves by his name. Certainly those who ruled over Judah. That's what he expected them to be. Not a big section, but a powerful section. Some powerful advice from a godly woman here. We are about out of time, so let's not go into the section on the virtuous woman. Any comments on this yet? Go ahead, Brian.
Just one thing. The pro-life movement, whatever, has this verse in their preamble, the 8. Speak for those who cannot speak for themselves.
Uh-huh.
That's just interesting that it's a good saying. You know, somebody's got to speak up for the unborn.
Yeah, absolutely. Can the unborn speak for themselves? Do they have rights as a human being? God thinks they do. God has always, we certainly go to, there's that whole description that we see in the law of Moses where you've got two men fighting so that a pregnant woman is hurt and it hurts the baby. What is the punishment? What if the baby dies? What's the punishment? Yeah. Does that sound like that baby had some rights? Apparently so. That was a human being who lost his life. And God sees it that way. I'm glad Brian brought it up because our society is very subtle about the way it does things. And it'll just use words that try to take the impact of reality away from us. It'll throw words around like fetus or like unborn tissues and stuff like that. When an unborn child is killed, what is it in God's sight?
Murder.
It absolutely is. I don't ever need to let that slip my mind. I don't ever need to let the world make me think, well, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, it's just that. No, it is what it is. And I need to make sure that I don't ever get desensitized to that, because the world will try to make me that way. Any thoughts on that? I'm glad you brought it up, Brian. Okay, let's stop there. And we'll plan on looking at the, Lord willing, the Proverbs 31 woman, not this coming Sunday. We'll have the gospel meeting, but the one following.